Hello, my friends. It's Monday, March 31st, 2025, and I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, your Red State refugee. And welcome to the Radical Russ Show, coming to you from Rolla J Studios in my undisclosed mountain hideaway in the beautiful state of Jefferson region of Southern Oregon. We got so much to catch up on today's show. Lots of news coming through in the weekend. We'll start off with kind of a rapid-fire segment, and then we've got some amazing stories to get to. A look at some voting shenanigans going on in Rockland County, New York, where the discrepancies between Kamala Harris's votes and the votes for Senator Kirsten Gillibrand are a little bit fishy. We're going to take a look at that. Also on the program today, Elon Musk and Doge are taking a look at rewriting the entire code base for Social Security. We'll tell you why that's a terrible idea. Then we move to the Beehive State, the state of Utah, which has made the idiotic move to ban fluoridated water. You know, Idaho's got to be thinking, Jesus, why didn't we think of that? Also, speaking of Idaho, in the Boycott Idaho segment, I got to tell you about a new law that creates felonious titties. That's right, criminal boobies in the state of Idaho. And then we'll wind things up with a look at a great post on the Bulwark. I've got to just give you some of the details of this on how we're going to go about building the dissident movement. All that coming up on the Radical Russ Show. But before we get started, I have to give a special shout out to two very special people out there who are celebrating their birthday. First of all, to my mentor, Madeline Martinez, the head of Oregon Normal in Portland, Oregon. It was 20 years ago this May that I first met Madeline Martinez and Anna Diaz, who were the people running the Oregon Normal chapter. Normal, if you don't know, is the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. I met them at the Global Cannabis March in Portland, Oregon, and it was there we started a friendship and a partnership that lasted the next 3 years as I worked with Oregon Normal. We put together the Oregon Normal Presents Cable Access Show. We ran the Oregon Medical Cannabis Awards for years. We ran those marches for years. We lobbied at the State House. We helped to pass a lot of laws. And couldn't have done it without Madeline Martinez. She's the one that brought me into the fold, made me the associate director of Oregon Normal, and introduced me to the folks at National Normal with whom I would go to work from 2008 through 2012, being the National Normal podcaster, which is what led me to being here with you. So thank you so much to Madeline Martinez. And of course, the biggest shout out goes out to my dad, John Belville, who turns 83 years old today. He often likes to quote Waylon Jennings, "If he knew he'd have lived this long, he'd have treated himself better when he was younger." Quite amazing. My dad is 83 years old. When I was growing up, he was the rockin' Johnny B, bopping the blues with a bottle of booze and a beautiful blonde in the backseat of a Buick. So if you're wondering where I have this predilection for alliterative nicknames, it might be from there. My dad's got an amazing story. For the first 40 years of his life, he was a professional musician playing drums in various country outfits, played with some B-level touring musicians like Orville Couch, Farron Young, Shelley West, David Frizzell, and so forth. I grew up on the road with Dad playing music. His bass drum case was my little playpen on the road. And unfortunately, also during that time, Dad was a raging alcoholic. Oh boy, he was really good at it. Not around me, though, so much. He pretty much kept it tame at home. It was the drinking out at the gigs and the nights after the gigs. But that changed. That all changed in 1980 when my dad went to the Mercy Center in Nampa, Idaho, and went through alcohol rehab and amazing recovery in that he went through detox, went through rehab, got sober, went back to Boise State University as a 40-year-old, 40-something, got his bachelor's degree in social work, became the president of the student social workers at Boise State University, graduated with that social work degree, and then went back to help others just like him. He went back into drug and alcohol counseling and helped so many people kick their addictions. He also worked with folks with developmental disabilities for a while. So the number of people my dad has helped is definitely in the hundreds, the thousands, possibly. Really proud of all the work he's done. And he's been sober ever since. He's been sober now probably, I guess it would be twice as long as he was drunk. So pretty amazing there. We held a 60th birthday party for him back when he turned 60, 23 years ago, because we had a fear that he would be dying soon. He got really sick, really, really sick back then. Had a terrible flesh-eating bacteria that took out a big chunk of his thigh. You know that, I always make fun of that that Jardiance ad, you know, the pharmaceutical Jardiance, where they say may cause a rare but fatal bacterial infection in the skin of the perineum. You've heard that ad, right? Fatal taint rot is what that is. Well, my dad had it. My dad had fatal taint rot, nearly killed him. But he survived, and we had a 60th birthday party. It was so funny. We had this big 60th birthday party, and my brother Josh, who's 15 years younger than me, and he's like 6'5". He's huge, right? My brother Josh showed up as the Grim Reaper. You got to understand my dad's sense of humor. He found that hilarious, right? So he had this 60th birthday party. We weren't sure how many more birthday parties he'd have, and here we are 23 years later. He's having his 83rd birthday party, and coming up on his 60th anniversary. Mom and dad have been married now coming up on 60 years. Amazing. He didn't think he'd make it to his 60th birthday. He's now looking at making it to a 60th anniversary. I love you so much, Dad. Thank you for making me think critically. As a kid, boy, Dad would not let me get away with not thinking critically. I used to ask him, Dad, what's this word mean? What's this word mean? I'd read something in a book somewhere, and he says, hey, you see that blue book over there? That big old blue book on the counter, it's got every single word in it in alphabetical order and all their definitions. Maybe you'll find it in there. So, yeah, when I told you I look shit up, I've been looking shit up since I was a kid, okay? It was no choice in my household. Again, happy birthday, Dad. I hope it is a wonderful one. Now, in other news, I just got notice here, according to my security files, that Tulsi Gabbard has revoked my security clearance again. Doggone it. I joke. I've never had security clearance, but also Adam Kinzinger and the other people that she's revoking security clearance for haven't had security clearances for a long time. We keep getting these notes that pop up that they're revoking their security clearance. It reminds me of Dean Wormer from Animal House. Put those boys on probation. Sir, they're already on probation. They are? Well, as of this moment, they're on double secret probation. There you go. Adam Kinzinger, Alexander Vindman, you've been double secret revoked. The other thing I was thinking about this weekend is how ironic it is that we get all these right-wingers that claim that lefties like me hate America. Why do you guys hate America so much? You all hate America. You're always complaining about the slavery and the genocide and the forced internment of Japanese. Why you got to complain about all that? Why can't you just love what's good about America? Folks, this lefty loves America. I love the hell out of America. On my 17th birthday, I signed up to serve the United States of America. I am a big fan of the United States. And the thing that's frustrating to me these days is while these righties complain lefties like me don't love America, they're in the business of tearing down everything that I would suggest is lovable about America. I love that America has free speech rights, but now they're tearing those down. I love that America gives billions in foreign aid to countries to help prevent disease and stop starvation from children. But we're tearing that down, tearing down the U.S. aid program. I love that America has strong military alliances with democracies and promotes democracy around the world and protects countries against aggression from foreign countries. But we're kind of not doing that anymore. We're backing off of supporting Ukraine. Looking like we might back out of NATO, threatening our closest military allies like Canada, like Greenland, like Panama. I love that America is the leader in the world in scientific research, but not for long, not the way it's going these days. We're going to have a massive brain drain as our scientists, our intellectuals try to escape fascism the same way Einstein and the German intellectuals escaped it in the 1930s and 40s. I love the fact that America offers due process to all people, due process in this country of the law, even for criminals, so that we can determine whether or not they actually did commit the crime. But, you know, not all the righties believe in that. In fact, here is Indiana Representative Spartz, Republican of Indiana, with a dangerously ignorant point to make.
You violated the law. You are not entitled to due process.
You violated the law. You're not entitled to due process. Well, what's the point of due process if it's not for people that violated the law?
Well, checkmate, liberals. Is if you just obeyed the law, you wouldn't need any due process.
Right. That's the way it works, man. Like, the people who need the due process are the people accused of breaking the law, because you can't really know they've broken the law until you have that due process. Oh my God, these people make my head hurt. I can't stand it. Oh, what else is going on? I got to catch up on. Oh, yeah, we had baseball's opening day. So, yeah, boring. I've never gotten into baseball. I'll be just honest about that right up front. I'm a football and basketball guy. I'll even watch hockey or golf before I watch baseball. And the thing I think that really annoys me the most about it, especially these days, is when you're watching baseball, if you're watching baseball, and they got the batter and the pitcher there, right? And they got that little box, little digital box they put in the strike zone. And then they throw the pitch and they can see the ball go into the box or outside of the box. And they put a little, you know, icon to where the pitch went across the plate. So you can tell it, that was a strike or that was a ball. And yet they still have some fat guy in black sitting behind the catcher and behind the batter. So he's got an obstructed view, trying to determine whether that ball that came across the plate at 90 miles an hour actually was a ball or a strike. Come on, baseball. If there is any sport in America that could be completely digitized, completely eliminate all of the on-field referees and umpires, it is baseball. From the whether the ball is a strike or a ball, whether or not the ball got to the first baseman before the person got to first base, whether or not the first baseman had his foot on the bag at the time, all this stuff can be covered digitally. Why do we keep human beings involved in this? Especially now that we've decided that sports gambling's okay. Especially with sports gambling being okay, how could anyone stand for an umpire there who's making human mistakes when there's millions of dollars of bets on the line? I saw one of these graphics here. It's a graphic for this particular umpire named Adam Hamari for a game that he called on March 29th, 25. So called this on Saturday. And this comes from a website called umpscorecards.com. So they take that little digital box and they review it. Like, how many times was the digital box right? How many times was the umpire not matching the digital box? This guy had a 78% called strike accuracy that day. So almost one out of four strikes that were strikes didn't get called strikes because of this human being behind the plate. Come on, baseball. Get rid of the umpires. Go all digital. Another piece of news I wanted to catch up on is the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which basically, you know, is what got us started into this whole Trumpocene era back in 2011 when Barack Obama was making remarks at the dinner and Donald Trump was in the audience and he started roasting Donald Trump. I really think that's the moment when Trump decided he was going to go on his revenge tour of being president and undoing everything Obama had ever done. That's about what he was doing, all the birther stuff, you know, leading up to that. And that's kind of what got Obama to call him out. Well, anyway, this White House Correspondents' Dinner always has a comedian delivering remarks. And some years are just absolutely devastating. Seth Meyers did a great set one year. Stephen Colbert did a great set. Coming up for this next White House Correspondents' Dinner was going to be Amber Ruffin, one of the head writers from the Seth Meyers show. She also had her own short-lived show on Peacock for a while, the Amber Ruffin show. She's absolutely brilliant. She is fantastic. Well, the White House Correspondents Association has decided to cancel its plans to have Amber Ruffin headline the dinner. Brian Stelter reports, quote, "The WHCA board has unanimously decided we are no longer featuring a comedic performance this year. At this consequential moment for journalism, I want to ensure the focus is not on the politics of division, but entirely on awarding our colleagues for their outstanding work, blah, 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 blah." Come on. We know what happened. Trump got all upset that the Amber Ruffin was going to be there. We can't have a black lesbian up on the stage at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, can we? And if you've seen Amber Ruffin's sets, oh, how merciless she could possibly have been tearing apart Trump and everything at that association dinner. Oh, I forgot Michelle Wolf. She did a great correspondence dinner, too. Let's not leave her name out. But yeah, so no surprise that they would cancel Amber Ruffin. But trying to dress this up as, oh, it's just a comedic performance we don't want. This is no time to be silly and funny. This is such a serious time for journalism. They say as the Washington Post folds, as the New York Times folds, as they'll capitulate to the desires of the Trump maladministration. Yeah, real serious time for journalism these days. Well, the Trumpian plan to take over Greenland is going swimmingly. Hope you caught the news this weekend where, well, all through the last week, they've been trying to set up a visit for, first of all, it was going to be Usha Vance, the second lady, the wife of J.D. Vance, the couch widow. Usha Vance was going to go over to Greenland for some photo ops, and the away team trying to get this ready for was going from door to door, house to house in Greenland, in the capital there, trying to find some family that would welcome Usha Vance to their home for the photo op. And nobody would say yes. Nobody in Greenland wanted to host Usha Vance. So they scrambled, and J.D. Vance announced that he would be coming along too. Hey, well, it's going so great in Greenland, I'm going to join my wife there. And, once again, they could not find anyone that wanted to host J.D. Vance in Greenland. So there's this photo of Vance. He goes to the army base there. Got a military base in Greenland. And he's in the chow hall with the other Marines and soldiers in the chow hall. And J.D. Vance is wearing a Marine's hat. Now, I know some of you out there thinking, okay, so what? He's in the chow hall with a bunch of Marines. He's wearing a Marine hat. What's the big deal? Well, those of you in the military know what the big deal is, and that is you do not wear your cover indoors. That's what we call a hat in the military. You do not wear your cover in the chow hall. So I know I'm just a National Guard E5 combat bassoonist, but even I know you do not wear your hat in the chow hall. So the trip was a flop. Vance couldn't find anyone there in Greenland that wanted to visit with him. Trump continues speaking belligerently about Greenland, said, oh yeah, we'll have it. We're definitely going to have it. It doesn't need to be military, but military options not off the table. Greenland would really be better off with us. Boy, Denmark's not doing a very good job of taking care of Greenland. Oh, really? Because, you know, the people in Greenland have a minimum wage of $22 an hour. People in Greenland get paid parental leave. People in Greenland have free health care. Why in the world will they want to join us and become just a territory with limited representation in our Congress or ability to vote for president? It's so ridiculous. This is just so ridiculous. And between this posturing at Greenland and bickering at Canada, they keep saying, Trump keeps saying, we need these for security reasons. We need security. Got to have security. Well, why would we need security by taking over Canada and Greenland when Canada and Denmark, of which Greenland is a part, are in NATO, and we're in NATO, and we're all NATO allies, and oh, That's why. Because if you might be planning to no longer be a part of NATO, if it's your plan to leave NATO, then Greenland and Canada wouldn't be your allies anymore, would they? The WhiskyLeaks story just will not go away, and I'm going to call it WhiskyLeaks. I've decided I don't like calling it Signal Gate. Why do we got to put gate on the end of every one of our scandals? I know the Watergate is why, but it's kind of like when you take alcoholic and then everything that someone's addicted to gets a caholic on the end of it. Shopaholic, you know, like if that were true, then an alcoholic would be an alcoholic colic. Anyway, I just don't like putting gate on the end of the words. I mean, imagine if the former CIA director under the H.W. Bush administration was involved in a scandal that had to do with putting in a series of locks on the Puget Sound to fill a pond for the founder of Microsoft. You know what that scandal would be? It would be Robert Gates's water gates for Bill Gates's water gate. I'm sorry. I had to do that. Anyway, the whole Signal Gate WhiskyLeaks thing won't die. The latest things on this is that we found Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, the DUI hire, the former Fox morning host, has decided that security is a family affair. Apparently, Hegseth has brought his wife to a number of meetings where very high-level, secure, classified information was being discussed. Oh, great. We're bringing the wife along. How about the kids, too? Bring your kids to the Pentagon Day. And, speaking of the Pentagon, we found that Hegseth has hired his brother to work in a position at the Pentagon. Rank nepotism going on here. So you can tell these people don't care at all about our national security. Trump has already come out and said, nobody's getting fired for this. Everybody's going to keep their jobs. The only guy they're mad at in this whole WhiskyLeaks scandal is Mike Waltz. Mike Waltz, the guy who added the journalist into the secret chat. And they're not mad at him for the fact that this secret chat got out. They're not mad at the fact that they're discussing classified stuff on Signal and evading FOIA requests and archive laws. They're mad because he had the phone number of a liberal journalist in his phone. What are you doing talking to the libs? Trump continues with his on-again, off-again tariff war with everybody over everything. And it's getting a little frustrating now for the economy. We saw the Dow Jones drop 700 points, almost 1.5%, something like that. S&P falling, NASDAQ falling. And this is the guy that campaigned on lowering our prices. I'll lower the prices on day one, he told us. And now, apparently, the prices are no big deal. NBC News is reporting that with regards to the auto tariffs that are being threatened, that are going to increase the cost of a car by $6,000 at least, Trump responded, quote, I couldn't care less. I hope they raise their prices, because if they do, people are going to buy American-made cars. We have plenty, end quote. Asked if he was concerned about car prices going up, Trump said, no, I couldn't care less, because if the prices on foreign cars go up, they're going to buy American cars, end quote. First of all, I do have to applaud one thing. He got the phrase right. It is, I couldn't care less. A lot of people say, I could care less, which means, yes, you could have less care. No, in this case, he could not care less. He has zero care for whether or not you have to pay more for a car. And there's something that's revealed in this quote to me. I love it where he says, because if the prices on foreign cars go up, they're going to buy American cars. This motherfucker thinks that Hondas and Toyotas are built entirely in Japan with Japanese parts. He thinks that BMWs and Volkswagens are made entirely in Germany, entirely with German parts, and that Fords and Chevys are built entirely in America, entirely with American parts. That's not how it works anymore. Cars have parts from all over the place. Toyota, Honda, BMW, Volkswagen have factories in America. Honda, or Ford and Chevy rely on parts that sometimes come from overseas. It's all intertwined now. There's not going to be, the Chevy costs $20,000 and the Toyota costs $20,000. And now, so because of the tariffs, the Toyota costs $26,000, but the Chevy stays the same? No, that's not what's going to happen here. The prices on all cars are going to go up. We are a global economy with global supply chains. He's such an idiot. And what's really frustrating about that is, even though he's such an idiot and he so demonstrably hates America and everything about America, a new CBS YouGov poll came out finding that Trump's approval rating, generally speaking, amongst all voters, is 50%. Trump's got a 50% approval rating and a 50% disapproval. The country is literally half and half on American fascism. Looking at some of the points in the poll, majorities feel 64% believe that Trump is not focusing enough on lowering prices. 55% say he's focusing too much on the tariffs. As far as where Trump's policies will take us financially, 42% believe his policies are making us worse off. Now, back in January, they asked the same question. 42% said they're making them better off. So it's just been about a reversal in how people see economics. And yet, the guy is still getting a 50-50 approval rating. How will the tariffs have an impact on prices? 72% of Americans believe there will be a short-term impact on increasing prices because of the tariffs. And despite that, people still giving a 50-50 approval rating. And it's because of idiocy like this. Who is more responsible for today's inflation rate? Today's inflation rate. Who's more responsible? 38% blame Joe Biden's policies. Only 34% blame Trump's policies. 19% blame both of them equally. As far as Trump's handling of immigration, 53% approve. Can you believe that? You got pictures of the Homeland Security director, video of her in front of a wall, tattooed prisoners, with credible reporting that there are innocent people in that prison. A gay barber, the brother of an autistic kid, a fan of Real Madrid soccer, who have no criminal records, who aren't gang members. Reporting came out this weekend as well that how they were instructed to find these gang members was to follow a very stringent protocol for determining that they were actually tren de arugula or aragua, excuse me. The stringent protocol, number one, are they Venezuelan? Number two, do they have tattoos? Lock them up. I'm only slightly exaggerating. They found this book of all the tattoos, you know, different examples of tattoos that are supposedly gang tattoos from this vicious, vicious gang of Venezuelans. Turned out to just be tattoos off of Instagram from some British tattoo artist. Just a collection of works. Having nothing to do with gangs, nothing to do with Venezuelans necessarily, just ornate tattoos. That's the level of consideration going into jailing these people in our concentration camps on another continent. Well, I guess El Salvador's technically on our continent. And 53% of the people are approving of this. We are beginning to learn, if we hadn't learned already, and I'm sure black and brown people knew this better than me, of just how large a proportion of the people of America are fine with fascism, are fine with cruelty. Also in the poll, 52% approve, I'm sorry, 52% disapprove of Trump's handling of the economy, and 56% disapprove of Trump's handling of inflation. So it could be the economy, stupid. It could be the economy that helps to bring him down, and not the fact that we're behaving like a fascist dictatorship. Amazing to me. When asked about Trump's program to deport immigrants illegally in the U.S., 58% approval. 58% of the people approving of no due process, of just rounding up brown people with tattoos. What a sick, sick country we are. Some good news in this poll, though. Should federal judges be allowed to review Trump's policies? 93% of Democrats say yes, they should. 81% of immigrants or independents, excuse me, say yes, they should. And 56% of Republicans still believe in judicial review. Well, that's good news. I don't know what's up with the 7% of Democrats and 19% of independents who do not agree with judicial review, but hey, we'll take what we can get, right? And then as far as the call to impeach federal judges that rule against Trump, 81% of Dems oppose that, 73% of independents oppose that, but 59% of Republicans support impeaching judges who rule against Trump. And the DOGE effort to cut staff at our government agencies is at 50-50. Half the people approve of this. We'll see where that number goes after the Social Security checks stop flowing. And when asked about reducing federal workforce impact programs you care about, 85% of Democrats say yes, these DOGE cuts are going to hurt the programs we care about. 62% of independents agree. But 69% of Republicans say, nah, laying off all the staff there at the National Institutes of Health, that's not going to be a problem. Getting rid of a bunch of people with Social Security, not going to hurt a thing. You're in a cult. And polling on the WikiLeaks, the signal messaging app matter, as they put it, 44% of the voters say that's a very serious problem. 31% say somewhat serious, with only a quarter of voters saying it's no big deal. So this has broken through. And I believe part of why the signal thing has broken through is it's granular to the people. People can understand this kind of scandal. You know, everybody's done text group chats and accidentally added someone to the chat. And the transparent nature of how serious the messages were, right? There's no dancing around, oh, this wasn't classified, this wasn't a war plan, it was an attack plan, is coming off as disingenuous bullshit, because everybody can see that when you say, hey, the bombs are going to drop at 12:45 and the planes are going to fly in at 1:15, that's a war plan. So it's breaking through to the people. And the other question, using the signal messaging app to discuss military plans, was not appropriate, according to 76% of the voters. So again, 24% thought it was appropriate, the same about 25% that said it's not that serious. So only one in four people are buying the bullshit when it comes to Signal. Even Republicans do not think this was appropriate. 91% of Dems and 80% of independents said it was not appropriate to use Signal. 56% of Republicans also agree. More items on the poll to tell you about. Trump having the U.S. take control of Greenland is disapproved of by 2/3 of voters, 67-33, disapprove of taking over Greenland. How should congressional Democrats approach Trump? Oppose Trump as much as possible is now up to 70%. On March 2nd, the beginning of the month, it was only at 64%. So it is increasing wisdom among voters that the Democrats should oppose Trump as much as possible. Now, this is just, they're just asking Democrats on that question, by the way. Only 30% of Democrats think we should try to find some common ground with Trump. And are the congressional Democrats doing enough to oppose Trump? According to the Democrats who want, the 70% of us that want the opposition to Trump to increase, 86% of us say they could be doing more. Do something. This is all from the CBS News YouGov survey. It was conducted March 27th and 28th, weighted to be representative adults nationwide, according to gender, ace, race, and education. I saw a bit of data come up on my feed this weekend that gave me pause, and it has to do with the results of the 2024 election. There are people out there that believe that there are some shenanigans going on, or were some shenanigans going on with the 2024 results. They found it improbable that Donald Trump would come back and win all seven of the swing states. It seemed odd that Kamala Harris would be packing arenas and having so much enthusiasm for her campaign, only to find she loses all seven swing states, and just about every precinct in America went more for Trump. It seemed a little hard to believe, and I've been on the fence about this. I want to believe that we have free and fair elections, that our elections are secure, that there's no way to hack them. But the conspiracy theorists are out there. They point out to things like the bomb threats that were called in to numerous heavily Democratic precincts, forcing the buildings to be completely evacuated. But so far, it hasn't really bubbled to the surface. It's still kind of underground, still in those conspiracy theory circles. But I saw some data. And you know me, I look shit up. I saw some data that made me pause just a little bit and wonder if perhaps they're on to something. And it takes us to Rockland County, New York. Now, Rockland County, New York, of course, the state of New York went for Kamala Harris. Rockland County did not. In the Rockland County results, Kamala Harris got 43% of the vote compared to the 55% that Donald Trump got. Okay. We can accept that, right? Maybe a conservative county, right? But then you look at the results for Kirsten Gillibrand, the Democratic senator for New York running for re-election, and she won Rockland County with 52.6% of the vote, whereas her Republican opponent got 46%. So Kamala Harris got 65,000 votes for president. Kirsten Gillibrand got 72,000 votes for senator. So there were around 7,000 people who would vote for the Democratic senator but vote for the Republican president or not vote for the Democratic president. Seems a little fishy, but yeah, you could see it. Maybe, you know, so the senators, some of these senators in blue states did outperform Kamala Harris. That's maybe not too surprising. Until you start digging down to the district level. And the first district that came across my feed was a district called Ramapo 35. The Ramapo 35 district in Rockland County, New York, found 331 votes for Kirsten Gillibrand versus 82 for the Republican. 331 to 82. The Democrat got 331 votes for Senate. But when we take a look at the votes for president in Ramapo 35, Kamala Harris got 0 votes. We're supposed to believe that in one district, in one county in New York, 331 people would vote for the Democratic senator, but zero would vote for the Democratic president? And what's more interesting here is the total number of votes in that district in the Senate race was 413, if I'm doing the math right in my head here. Yeah, 413, 417, if you include the write-ins, 417 votes in that one district where the senator got 331 votes. But if you look at Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, there was 552 total votes for Donald Trump. Like an extra 140 votes there. Or there were 140 people who voted for Trump who didn't bother to vote at all for senator. Okay. maybe that's true. Maybe that happened. That could happen. Then I start looking at some of the other Ramapo districts. Ramapo 30, 3 votes for Kamala Harris. Ramapo 30, 36 votes for Kirsten Gillibrand. We look up at Ramapo 28, 5 votes for Kamala Harris, 64 votes for Kirsten Gillibrand. Ramapo 21, 2 votes for Kamala Harris. Ramapo 21, 102 votes for Kirsten Gillibrand. Ramapo 45, 0 votes for Kamala Harris, 34 votes for Kirsten Gillibrand. Ramapo 55, get this, 2 votes for Kamala Harris, 909 votes for Kirsten Gillibrand. Really? Ramapo 58, 1 vote for Kamala Harris, 544 votes for Kirsten Gillibrand. Ramapo 84, 0 votes for Kamala Harris, 30 votes for Kirsten Gillibrand. Ramapo 95, 4 votes for Kamala Harris, 514 votes for Kirsten Gillibrand. Ramapo 97, 0 votes for Kamala Harris, 292 votes for Kirsten Gillibrand. Ramapo 98, 5 votes for Kamala Harris, 735 votes for Kirsten Gillibrand. Ramapo 111, 7 votes for Kamala Harris, 164 votes for Kirsten Gillibrand. Ramapo 117, 4 votes for Kamala Harris, 214 votes for Kirsten Gillibrand. Ramapo 118, 1 vote for Kamala Harris, 567 votes for Kirsten Gillibrand. So we've got 4 of those districts, 4 of those Ramapo districts where Kamala Harris got 0 votes and Kirsten Gillibrand got dozens or hundreds. We've got many more of those districts where Kamala Harris got in the single digits and Kirsten Gillibrand got dozens or hundreds more. Something fishy is going on. All right, time to shift gears a little bit and catch you up on what's happening with President Musk. He's been out in public a lot lately complaining so much that the people don't like him. Why do people not like poor Elon Musk? What a shame here. So I want to just give you a few of the clips here. One of the things he had to say during one of his speeches, he says, this was on C-SPAN, and he was holding a rally because he's down in Wisconsin trying to buy the Supreme Court election. The Wisconsin Supreme Court is currently a 4-3 court with a liberal bent, 4-3 liberal. But one of the justices is leaving and there is an election because they have elected judicial spots in Wisconsin. There's an election between Brad Schimmel, a former Republican AG and current conservative jurist in Waukesha County, versus Susan Crawford, who's a liberal jurist from Dane County. And they've pumped almost $100 million into this race, with Elon Musk kicking in about $20 million. Because keeping this court liberal means they will keep drawing the lines properly and not gerrymandering the state of Wisconsin. If Musk can get his guy in and make this a conservative court, they can go back to the Republican drawn maps, gerrymander the hell out of the state, send more Republicans to Congress. So this could have an effect on the 2026 elections with respect to who gains control of the Congress. It also has to do with Elon Musk and his Tesla corporation, because Wisconsin has this law about having independent car dealerships. You have to sell, you can't exclusively sell your car only through your own corporate dealership. You also have to let independents do it. Well, Musk doesn't like that. He wants all Teslas sold at Tesla dealerships. So he wants to try to get the court on his side to be able to change that law. So he's out in Wisconsin. He does this rally where he's giving away $1 million checks. He's doing his old game where I'm going to pay you $100 if you sign this petition, and I'll give $1 million to 2 lucky recipients who've signed this petition. But really what he's trying to do is buy votes. And this is blatantly illegal under Wisconsin law. And people were wondering, hey, what, when Elon Musk shows up there in Wisconsin,
The attorney general ought to meet him there with some state troopers and put him under arrest for violating the law. The law says you can't offer anything of value to entice people to vote. He's breaking the law. Arrest him. Oh, no, no, we can't do that. See, Elon Musk is rich. You can't just arrest rich white guys. That would be unseemly. So they went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Again, the 4-3 liberal Supreme Court. Asking them, hey, would you pretty please stop him from doing this? Court. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court came back unanimously and said, no, and we're not going to do it. So nobody will stand up. Nobody will be brave enough to finally slap the cuffs on one of these people for fear of the retaliation, the billions in lawsuits that would come. So we're pretty much recognizing here in America that there are two systems of justice, right? We are living under two Americas. There's the system of justice for you and me if we go into contempt of court or refuse a subpoena or try to offer people things to vote or drop secret war plans in an unencrypted chat. You know, you and I, we'd be going to prison for stuff like that. But, you know, the rich, they not like us, right? So Musk is at this event and he says, quote, I did not think of myself as right, but then the left went in the other direction and now everyone is a Nazi. And I'm like, wait a second. Do you know what that means? Obviously not. Yeah, Elon Musk is upset that everyone keeps calling him a Nazi. He tweeted, the goal of the left is to destroy my influence. So they relentlessly push negative propaganda about me like the fake Nazi stuff and ignore anything positive. They are evil. Yeah, the fake Nazi stuff. The fake Nazi stuff. Dude, maybe if you don't go out in public doing the Sieg Heil, maybe if you're not out there supporting the AfD, the far right party in Germany that wants to bring fascism back, maybe if you're not actively involved in dismantling the federal government, maybe if you didn't come from an apartheid system that made your family rich, maybe if you weren't peddling these false conspiracies about South Africa trying to root out the white man, maybe if you weren't in support of this policy in the Trump administration that is giving preferential treatment to immigrants of Afrikaner descent, that is the white South Africans, maybe then we wouldn't be calling you a Nazi. Musk also, he says, your comment about the Matrix is ironic because we watched the first Matrix and the sequel yesterday. I like bringing this up just because, you know, Elon Musk has a trans daughter, Vivian, who is fabulous. Musk actually went out and tweeted the other day that my son Xavier is dead, killed by the woke mind virus. You know, dead naming Vivian. A guy considers his own child dead because she's trans. Of course, the irony here when he says he watches The Matrix is, of course, The Matrix is a trans allegory written and directed by trans directors who have explicitly stated in numerous interviews that The Matrix is a trans allegory.
If you have a classroom of 25 or 30 kids, it is literally impossible to spend time with every kid individually, or you can spend too little time. But what you can do is set them up with an AI.
That's Musk's plan to address overcrowded classrooms. There's just no way to fix the problem of overcrowded classrooms without bringing gigabytes and petaflops into it. We got to have an AI. We got to waste tons of energy and computing time on an AI to raise our kids, to teach our kids in the classroom so that they'll be getting more personal attention. Because, you know, taxing billionaires and hiring more teachers, why, that's crazy talk. One more Musk quote.
And the Fed. Oh, yeah, I always wanted to say that. I think there are 20,000 people who work at the Fed. Why do we have so many people at the Fed? And what do they do?
They regulate our monetary policy in an independent fashion from the administration. And they've been doing so quite well for decades now. But it is a little telling that You don't know what the Fed does. You want to get in here and muck around with our federal government, and you don't know how it works. So that was Elon Musk in Wisconsin at the rally. Before that, he had an interview with Bret Baier from Fox News with his Doge boys sitting around him and had to complain about Tim Walz.
Does that help Tesla? I mean, you had Tim Walz, who's a huge jerk, running around on stage with a Tesla stock price, where the stock price had gone in half. And he was overjoyed. What an evil thing to do. What a creep. What a jerk. Like, who derives joy from that? And
yeah, a terrible, evil creep who came up on stage and showed how your company is tanking its stock because you are a fascist. But yeah, Tim Walz is the jerk, not the guy who dead names his own daughter and considers her dead to him. Not that guy. That guy's not a jerk. Not the guy who brings his little boy X everywhere he goes and wears him like a human shield to protect him from assassination. That guy's not a jerk. It's Tim Walz, the guy who's teasing you about your stock price. Isn't it telling what he finds evil has to do with capitalism, has to do with ownership, has to do with wealth? That's all these people think about. They are dysfunctional. Like, if you knew someone who had in his house stacked to the ceilings old newspapers and garbage, you'd call them a hoarder and think they're mentally ill. But when they are stacking to the ceiling wealth that they could never possibly spend in a whole lifetime, for some reason, we're supposed to venerate those people. Here's another little clip from Elon Musk on that Bret Baier interview.
Finally, what's the biggest thing for you that keeps you up at night?
Well, there's a lot of things, I suppose, that I worry about, but and some of these things will seem esoteric to people. The birth rate is very low in almost every country, and something, unless that changes, civilization will disappear. America had the lowest birth rate, I believe, ever. That was last year. Places like Korea, the birth rate is 1/3 replacement rate. So that means in 3 generations, Korea will be 3 or 4% of its current size. And nothing seems to be turning that around. Humanity is dying. And people, it's just not something we evolved to react to.
The birth rate is very low in almost every country, he says. Except when you take a look at the birth rates of all the countries in the world, it's not low in almost every country. It's low in the developed countries. It's low in the white countries. You look at the African continent, you look at Southeast Asia, you look at South America, their birth rates are quite okay. They're putting out a whole lot of people. But the white birth rate is too low, and unless that changes, he says, civilization will disappear. He says the Koreans are only having a 1/3 birth rate, so in 2 or 3 generations, there'll only be 3 to 4% of the population of Korea left. like, yeah, okay. So this year, there's going to be 8 billion people on Earth. And then, a few years from now, there'll only be 8 million people on Earth. And then a few years from there, there'll only be 8,000 people on Earth. And then eventually, there'll only be 8 people on Earth. And then eventually, we'll all be gone. Because this trend would continue in a linear fashion forever and ever, and nothing would ever change it. There would never be a blip or a change that would cause people to want to have more babies. You want to know why the birth rate is down in America, Elon Musk? Nobody can afford a fucking kid. People can't afford housing. They can't afford childcare. They can't afford healthcare. Who wants to bring a kid into this world they can't afford? Obviously, you can. You've got 14 kids from 4 different women. But the rest of us can't afford that shit. And you're making it worse. Now, speaking of making it worse, the most shocking part of Elon Musk's news this week is the revelation that he wants to turn these Doge kids, these coders, over to Social Security to rewrite the entire Social Security code base. That's right, rewrite the entire programming for Social Security. Now, let me explain some stuff to you here. First of all of the Social Security code base is written in a programming language called COBOL. COBOL is the Latin of programming languages. It's like this old, old language that isn't used for modern development anymore, but was in great use throughout the mainframe era. It's one of the software packages, one of the languages, that I first learned to code in. I actually can do some COBOL coding and some Fortran coding and some basic coding. I started on an HP mainframe in 1983. Just grabbed a manual and start learning. So let me tell you why trying to rewrite the entire Social Security code base, and by the way, he thinks they can do it in a few months. In a few months! They can rewrite the entire Social Security code base. Oh my God! Well, first of all, let me explain some stuff about language and coding. COBOL is very hard to improve on because it runs great. COBOL was specifically designed back in the day when we didn't have a shit ton of processing power. You've got more processing power on your digital watch than we had in the 60s and 70s when these code bases were written. So when you wrote code back in the day, it was efficient as hell. You had to make every bit of code streamlined and efficient. So COBOL systems, the code itself was written to maximize the efficiency of the hardware it's written on, that it's written for. So putting some other language on top of this old hardware isn't going to be more efficient. This new language stuff is going to have to be translated and reconfigured to match some of the old hardware that's in use. And these COBOL systems, not only do they run billions of transactions, banks run COBOL as well. Banks have been running COBOL for years and years and years. They run these billions of transactions. They run fast. They run efficiently. And the code is damn near bug-free. Very little error in COBOL code. Not because it's a special language that doesn't have errors. Every language has errors. Every coder makes bugs, sure. But COBOL has been in use for so many decades now, they found all the bugs. It's been decades. The mistake popped up, we cured it. So there's very few bugs, if any, left in COBOL. Oh, and by the way, just a little bit of computer trivia. The term computer bug comes from a mainframe issue where a computer programmer named Grace Hopper was trying to figure out why some circuits were malfunctioning, and she opened up the machine and found that an actual moth had flown and shorted out some circuits there, and that was a bug. That was the first computer bug. That's where the term comes from. And Grace Hopper, by the way, went on to be one of the people that helped contribute to the development of COBOL. So COBOL runs very bug-free, very fast, very efficiently. And when you try to rewrite it, because this has been tried in other places, banks have tried to rewrite their COBOL code. And they found, first of all, you got to find some talent that knows COBOL. Ain't a whole lot of new Doge kids know any COBOL. It's all old guys like me in their 50s, 60s, sometimes their 70s. We were the guys that got called up during Y2K. When Y2K was happening and all the banks were afraid, oh my God, the digits are going to reset and everything's going to get messed up and the world's going to fail. You know why Y2K didn't happen? Why it was like a fizzle? Because old guys like me were called in to fix COBOL code. So you got to find that. You got to find the staff that's going to know the COBOL that you're changing. And then when you try to rewrite it, you're writing brand new billions of lines of code. So certainly there's going to be bugs involved. More bugs than would be necessary if you just kept the COBOL running. So how likely is it going to be that they can go in and rewrite COBOL in just a few months and have Social Security run fine without any glitches? I give it a chance of about one to Elon Musk's net worth. Well, normally this would be the time we'd start our Boycott Idaho segment. We got to go just a little southeast of Idaho to get started today because the Beehive State, the state of Utah, has done something that rivals Idaho in stupidity. I'm sure Idaho is jealous that they didn't think of this first because the state of Idaho, the governor, has signed a law banning fluoridated water. That's right, they've banned fluoride in the water. And when we're talking about fluoride in water, we are talking about 0.7 grams of fluoride, 0.7 or 700 milligrams if you prefer, 700 milligrams of fluoride for every 1,000 kilograms of water. That works out to 0.7 versus a million. They're claiming that fluoride is somehow harmful. The fluoride is harming people. You know how much fluoride you have to consume to be able to have any adverse risk from fluoride? When we're talking, there's 0.7 grams, 700 milliliters. I'm sorry, 700 milligrams in every 1 million grams of water. You would have to consume 357 liters of water a day for the fluoride in that water to have any effect on you. You would die of water intoxication before the fluoride would kill you. And the tiny, tiny amount of fluoride we're talking about, one part per million, less than one part per million, you know, 0.7 parts per million here. You know how small that is, one part per million? 1 inch in 16 miles is one in a million. There's a million inches in 16 miles, so 1 inch is a part per million. 1 minute in 2 years of time is a part per million. One cup of water in a swimming pool is a part per million. So we're talking about minuscule amounts of fluoride. And as we all know, at least I thought we all knew, fluoride prevents cavities and improves the strength of your teeth on average. And I'm getting this information from, by the way, I'm no doctor. I'm getting it from Andrea Love, PhD, a biomedical scientist. You can find her at immunologic.org. Immunologic.org. On average, young children in areas with fluoridated water have two fewer decayed teeth than children in a similar age in areas without fluoridated water. So basically, what we're going to have here is Utah mouth. Come about, you know, 15 years from now, it's going to be really easy to see which kids grew up in Utah by the missing and messed up teeth they're going to have from not having a fluoride. Okay, now time for our Boycott Idaho segment, and I'm going to take you back to a previous segment. Do you remember a while back I told you about how my hometown mayor in Nampa, Debbie King, and the city council there put out a statement that they were officially against gay pride? Yeah, back in last year, 2024, in the summer, they had a gay pride event, the first one ever in my hometown of Nampa, Idaho, in Canyon County at Lakeview Park. So this got written up in the Washington Post because it's, you know, such a conservative county. Canyon County is to Boise what Orange County is to LA. It's basically the conservative county in Idaho, which is kind of like saying the sauna in hell. It's a bit redundant, but it's very conservative. So the mayor and the city council were officially against the Pride event, but the Pride event went on. And at that Pride event, there was a disturbance that caused an extreme emergency in the Handmaid State. For out there in Lakeview Park, in public, in front of God and everyone, during those festivities, someone was dancing around topless. Oh my gosh. Naked boobies. Nampa City Council member Sebastian Griffin was so offended, he approached a Nampa police officer who was observing the topless dancer. Griffin demanded the officer arrest the woman for indecent exposure. The officer explained he could do nothing because the law does not prevent a man with breast implants from being topless. So trying to discern what exactly was going on there, my theory is this was a transgender woman dancing and the cop was, you know, misgendering her, saying she's a man. But I read some of the other reports, and some of the other reports said this was a man who said he was a man, who just happened to have breast implants and was taking his top off to make a point. So I'm not sure if this was a transgender woman or a man with implants, and the way it was reported makes it kind of unclear. So I'll try to follow up on that and see what I can find. But for the record, Idaho law, at least back then, 2024, did not prevent a woman from exposing her breasts in public either, because the indecency laws in the state of Idaho at the time criminalized the public exposure of genitalia. And court cases have decided in the past that boobs are not genitalia. So, fearful that Idaho would soon be overrun with people flaunting their boobs in public, that council member Griffin worked with the legislators to craft House Bill 270, which was signed into law by Governor Little last week. And the law was signed with an emergency provision, so it goes into effect immediately, to criminalize the exposure of, quote, developed female breasts, adult male breasts that have been medically or hormonally altered to appear like developing or developed female breasts, or artificial breasts intended to resemble female breasts, end quote. So, no boobies. You cannot show your boobies in public. Women, you cannot show your boobies. Men, if you've hormonally or medically altered your boobies, you cannot show them out in public. Nobody can show boobies in public that are artificial boobies. We cannot show boobies. But beware the unintended consequences in something like this. Adult male breasts that have been medically or hormonally altered could include guys that took steroids for too long and had that gynecomastia kick in, where they get the boob tissue start, then they go off the steroids and it gets bigger. That's a hormonal alteration. Hell, if you wanted to really press it, you could say that fat, obese guys with big old man boobs have been hormonally altered. But that's not all. That's not all that they criminalized. The law also adds toys or products designed to resemble male or female genitals as something you cannot display publicly. So you went to the bachelor party and picked up a hat that's got a dildo sticking off the end of it. Can't wear that in public. Oh, and you definitely cannot put the truck nuts on your 4x4. You know those? The little fake plastic balls they put on the back of their truck to make their truck transgender? I always like to point that out. You know, your truck was born without balls, and you added balls as a choice later. Doesn't that make your truck trans? So, what kind of crime is it now in the state of Idaho to show your boobs in public? It is a misdemeanor to show your boobs or to display truck nuts on your car. Misdemeanor. But a third strike, if you're caught showing your boobs 3 times in 5 years, it's a felony. A felony for showing your boobs, and you can be imprisoned up to 5 years. So there you have it. If you go to my list at radicalrust.com/Idaho, scroll on down, because this one is reason number 50. You should boycott the handmade state. I wanted to share with you all something that I find to be one of the most important articles written lately. You can find this at thebulwark.com. It's written by Jonathan V. Last, and it's entitled How to Think and Act Like a Dissident Movement. And leave it to the Bulwark and the center-right Republicans to actually come up with something that the Democrats should be coming up with. This is almost like a Project 2027 or a Project 2029. I don't know what year you want to assign to it, but this is it, a roadmap to what we should be doing right now as the Democratic Party. Again, that the Democrats didn't come up with this is so on brand. I just wanted to share some of the points from it. The first point is that we must see the world right now as an us versus them, in that any institution that is not explicitly anti-Trump is pro-Trump. We've seen this with Paul, Weiss, the law firms that are folding, the New York Times, the Washington Post that have capitulated, the various corporations that threw million-dollar checks at Trump. Any of those organizations that are not explicitly anti-Trump are explicitly pro-Trump. That's the first thing we need to get into our head. The second thing, the public events that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders have been throwing are perfect. The dissident movement needs to begin by focusing on rallies, focusing on personalities we can rally around. It's exactly what we need. The people out here are eager, raring to go, ready to march, but we have to follow someone. And when you look at the history of dissident movements, this is how it works. This is how it starts. When you look at the other countries that had to fight back against fascism. So keep doing the rallies. But one important point that Jonathan makes in this post, don't rally in Washington, D.C. Don't rally in New York. According to the author, he says, when you look at the history of dissident movements, they almost always begin in the outer provinces. Continuing, the autocrats' power is greatest near the literal center of the government they control. The further you get from their power center, the weaker their hold and the more risks they have to take if they want to put down demonstrations. So, she's gone to Denver and Phoenix. Keep going to the small towns, the smaller areas. The Nashvilles, the Houstons, the Oaklands. I guess Houston's not small, but Oakland, Oklahoma City, Boise. Go to these places outside of the power centers. Keep building the rallies. You build these rallies, you build the people in the streets. That encourages more people. It's like the junior high dance. Nobody wants to be the first ones out on the floor. We get these rallies happening, get them to be events people expect large attendance to, and they will grow. They will multiply. There's a big event taking place this Saturday, April 5th. This will be the way we activate a large infrastructure of people who can be counted on for the next rally and the next rally. And when we talk about an infrastructure, we're not talking about fundraising. This is one of the biggest problems the Democratic Party has right now is we say, hey, what can we do? What can we do? The only thing they say is give us money. Okay, to do what? And that just turns people off. The feeling that the Democrats, as I showed in that poll that I talked about earlier in the show, that 83% of the Democrats that say that they want to see some change aren't seeing enough change. So don't build this as a fundraising list. Keep Act Blue out of it. Keep the Democratic Party fundraising arm out of it. This should be a membership list, a group list, an activation list for people to be active, to get out and do things, to register to vote, to turn out for elections, to go to the next rally. The next thing to do is to continue to fight as outsiders, to understand that we are against the billionaires and the oligarchy. This is starting to take effect with the Tesla boycotts. that are happening. We've seen it with the rejection of the anti-DEI push at Target, where Target's stock is collapsing. So continue this mass movement with targeted political strikes, boycotts, special elections like the one in Wisconsin, the special elections that are coming up in Florida. And another point is that we respond to their efforts to flood the zone. Remember Steve Bannon, that was his term, as we flood the zone with shit. They're so busy responding to one thing, they can't respond to the next thing. Well, we use that against them. We flood the zone with their shit. Every bad thing that happens everywhere in the world from now on is Trump's fault. It's Trump's fault. Prices are too high. It's Trump's fault. Can't get a vaccine. It's Trump's fault. Inflation's too high. It's Trump's fault. Ukraine is falling. It's Trump's fault. Everything has to be Trump's fault. Attack them for everything. Next step is we have to elevate the corruption. We have to show that it's the billionaires against us. And part of that is exposing and fighting the corruption on our side too, looking at you, Nancy Pelosi, and your insider stock trading. It's well past time for anybody who wants to be a leader in this movement, like AOC, to swear off corporate campaign donations, to swear off dark PAC money, to make this a people-powered movement. And then, once we've done rallies all across the country, once we've built that infrastructure, once we've attacked, when the moment is right, we then take it to DC. And that's why you have to build these rallies in other places first. We have to get people used to the idea that, hey, when we call for a rally, it's going to be a rally. It's going to be a big event. You don't want to miss it. There's a FOMO. There's a fear of missing out. Build enough of those. Then next year, 2026, springtime, we throw the big march in Washington and we put millions in the street. And by doing this, we can show the Democratic Party that if they act boldly like we are, we will have their backs. This is a fantastic roadmap. Again, the author is Jonathan V. Last. The article is called How to Think and Act Like a Dissident Movement. He wrote it a week ago today. You can find it at thebulwark.com, and I believe he's made it free, no paywall, to be able to read it. I encourage everyone to check this out. I'll post a link to it on my website on the podcast page. Well, that's all the time we've got for today's podcast, and my God, that's plenty of podcast, isn't it? Whew, went pretty long on this one. The Radical Russ Show is produced, directed, researched, written, recited, posted, and catered by me, Radical Russ Belville, and governed by Creative Commons share-alike licensing. My main theme is We Love the Herb by Herbal Nation, and interstitial music is by freestockmusic.com and by BTEMO, courtesy of freetouse.com/music. And for those of you listening for the post-credits comment, here it is. I saw this post on Blue Sky where someone asked, when did America become a place where people take joy in suffering, celebrating job losses, cheering immigrant arrests, ignoring terrified school children, and applauding when neighbors lose public assistance? What happened to basic human decency? And the response from some people, including George Takei, who I picked this up from, he said, this is the result of decades of civic poisoning by Fox News and the right-wing echo chamber and channels. And there were a lot of responses like that. As if this is all something new. As if Americans weren't inculcated in cruelty since the founding of this nation. I mean, my God, we used to burn women that were suspected of witchcraft. We hauled Africans in chains in the bottom of boats to labor, enslaved, to build this country. We used to hold picnics when we'd lynch them and put our faces on postcards. We gave Native Americans and their children infected blankets of smallpox. We decimated the population of bison. Killed bison, tried to wipe out an entire species because we knew it would starve the Indians out. We rounded up Japanese Americans and put them into internment camps. What do you mean this is a result of civic poisoning by Fox News and right-wing echo chambers? This is built into our character from day one. Fox News just exploits that. Anyway, you can contact me by email at radicalrus@gmail.com. Call my message line at 877-RUS-420. That's 877-877-420. And reach me on social media on Blue Sky as RadicalRuss.com and nowhere else. You can support this podcast financially by donating to @RadicalRuss on Venmo, $RadRuss on Cash App, or via PayPal on my website at RadicalRuss.com. Get this podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, my website, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and until next time, take care of each other.
You plant it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down.